Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
Good afternoon and welcome to an archive edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. On Wednesday, the night before Thanksgiving, a beloved Baltimore television newsman made his final appearance in a newscast before retiring after a 52-year career. Stan Stovall is an award-winning news anchor who's been a fixture on local television for decades. In 1971, at a station in Phoenix, Arizona, Stan became the youngest anchor in the United States and the first African-American anchor in the state of Arizona. He was 18 years old. His career behind the desk and in the field has taken him to Philadelphia and St. Louis, and as a journalist with a keen interest in international affairs, he has reported from Southeast Asia, Central America, Russia, Ukraine, and Italy. But it is his work at WMAR and WBAL that has endeared him to generations of viewers in the Baltimore metropolitan area. In September, he was inducted into the Gold Circle by the National Capital Chesapeake Bay Chapter of the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences in honor of his 50-plus years in TV broadcasting. A Gold Circle Award is an honor that has been bestowed on only 23 people. Having made the decision to step away from the anchor desk, we thought it'd be great to ask Stan to reflect on his career. And as you'll hear him explain, when we spoke in late September, the exact date of his final broadcast was a closely held secret. Stan Stovall joined me in Studio A. Stan, it is great to see you.
Tom, pleasure to see you too. It's been a while.
It has, and I'm glad you are taking the time. Announcement about when your actual last day is going to be at WBAL? Have you thought that through?
You know, it's interesting, Tom, because the station made the announcement, and we negotiated my retirement August of last year, and they put it out there that, but they left off the exact date. They wanted to leave it innocuous for, quite frankly, I don't know why. So technically, my end date has been embargoed by them. I'm not supposed to tell you. If I tell you, you know what I'd have to do.
That would be messy.
Right. So let me just simply say that it's a matter of weeks. I'm a matter of weeks away now. Okay. A lot of people thought I'd retired already. Once the announcement came out, they were thinking, okay, the end of 2020. And, I keep reminding them, no, I'm still on the air every night, whatever. So it's been a bit confusing. But yet at the same time, the station's been great the way they've handled it. And I'm blessed to finish off my career at a place like WBAL-TV. They've treated me very, very well. Of course, this is my second time there.
Yeah.
So 20 years this time. 6.5 years back in the late 70s, early 80s as their primary anchor.
You've treated them pretty well, too.
I'd like to say it's been a mutual, how shall we say, a blessing, so to speak. I have to wonder what would have happened in my career if I had stayed in Baltimore, the first time around, rather than leaving in 83, and I went back to St. Louis for 3 years, then went to Philadelphia for 3 years, and moved overseas and lived in Southeast Asia for 6 months, freelancing and covering a war. But you know what, Tom? Sometimes you have to make those moves to grow professionally. Mm-hmm. And I was at that point in my career where I felt like I needed to grow some more and expand and get some more knowledge.
Because your total career, I mean, you hit the 50-year mark 2.5 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, here you are still going.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because this market, and I've lived here 40 years mm-hmm. now, but this market seems to be a place where TV anchors stick around for a while.
They do.
And I think I think about people like Al Sanders, mm-hmm. Jerry Turner. These are the people that people point to as, longtime fixtures. Mm-hmm. But your career, even here in Baltimore, has outlasted theirs
by a decade.
By
or
more than a decade.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, but they were legends. It's funny because I hear people use that word in describing me, and I don't feel like a legend. I always tell people, you know what? I'm just a Baltimorean taxpayer Marylander like everybody else. And, words like legend, things like that. I'm flattered. Don't get me wrong, Tom. But I'm very low-key, humble kind of a guy. And I just like to consider myself just like everybody else out here, taxpaying citizen and, you know, going to work every day. And
Well, you are a low-key, humble guy. You and I have known each other for a while, and so I certainly know that to be true. But you also are, I think, a paradigm of what it means to work hard and to understand what you need to do to succeed in this business. There have been, in that 52-year career, there have been some lows. Mm-hmm. You were at WMAR, mm-hmm. Riding high, top of the ratings, yep. And then all of a sudden you weren't, because right. that's how this business works.
Right.
And recovering from that, your return to WBAL was under very different circumstances than you had experienced before. Yep. I think that's a really good lesson for people. Talk about those years and that transition.
Well, it was probably the most bizarre period of my life and of my career. For the most part, I have been blessed to pretty much make the moves that I wanted to make when they were good for me. Of course, I started out in Phoenix, Arizona. I was 17 years old when I first started, still in high school, integrated the industry in the state of Arizona, first African-American TV reporter in the state. As you mentioned, a year later, after I graduated from high school, they then made me the weekend anchor. So now I'm the youngest news anchor in the U.S. at the age of 18. And worked at two stations in Phoenix, and then started a path of people, you know, recognizing I'm out there working and offering me jobs in bigger markets, from Phoenix to St. Louis. Was in St. Louis. And the difference, when we say market size, I'm not sure people are aware of this. There's roughly about 320 different markets in the United States, cities that have TV stations. I started in Phoenix, which was the 34th largest market in the country at the time, got a job in St. Louis, which was the 13th largest market in the country.
So that's a step up, a big one.
Huge step up.
Yeah.
Huge step up. Not only market size-wise and recognition-wise, but also pay-wise.
Sure.
You know, you double your pay kind of thing. So as you move up, you do better. But for the first 8.5 years in the business, it was always as weekend anchor and a reporter. 1978, WBAL approached me about coming here to give me my first opportunity to be a primary weekday anchor. So that was another step up professionally. And it was great moving here in 70. I love Baltimore. I've lived here longer than I've lived any place else.
Right.
I'm originally from Rochester.
Having lived at a bunch of places, right.
Oh, yeah.
You have roots in Rochester.
Originally from Rochester, grew up in Phoenix, Arizona, high school, went to Arizona State, started the business in Arizona. But I've lived here probably three times longer than I lived in Phoenix. For example, so back to St. Louis when I left here in 83, a growth thing again. And then from St. Louis, while I was in St. Louis that second time, did a lot of enterprising exclusive stories during the Contra Wars in Central America, kicking the network's butts on those. They couldn't figure out how. They didn't know that my best friend in life was the personal bodyguard for Adolfo Calero, the president of the Contra organization. So I'm getting all these exclusive interviews with Calero and exclusive video, whatever, and then thinking, wow, this guy's really good. I get hired at the CBSO in Philadelphia. Another major step up.
An even bigger market than St. Louis
by goodness,
a lot.
From the 13th market to the number 4 market now. So, you know, and here's the funny thing about Philly. You work in this business for a lot of years trying to get to the network because you think the streets are paved with gold. Once you get to the network, unlimited budget, you can travel, whatever. I was doing more international reporting out of St. Louis than ever had a chance to do when I got to Philly. The only thing I got to do in Philly, I was anchoring two newscasts a day. And my only travel was down to Washington. I was, you know, their Capitol Hill correspondent for presidential addresses and congressional things. They never gave me a chance to go out of the country to do what I really enjoy doing, international, political-related kind of stories. And it got kind of frustrating. So I decided, you know what? I'm going to leave. I'm going to seek, greener grass someplace else. I put about 10 different stations on hold that I was negotiating with when the same friend, who was Adolfo Calero's personal bodyguard, he's now in Southeast Asia. He's a military trainer, former mercenary, military. He's now training the Burmese rebels against the military.
You hang out with some interesting dudes.
Yeah, which is, you know, suppressing the people. And the same thing that happened in Tiananmen Square in China in 1991. The same thing happened in Rangoon, Burma, a full year earlier.
Now called Myanmar.
Now
right.
Myanmar. Mm-hmm. 3,000 men, women, and children slaughtered by the army because while they were protesting for democracy, a democratic government. So my friend calls me from Thailand, and he says, you're not going to believe what happened here yesterday. And I said, what? And he said, man, they had a wholesale massacre of pro-democracy, unarmed demonstrators, men, women, children, priests, monks, I said, now, come on, man. I didn't see any of that on network news or any major news. That's because foreign journalists weren't allowed in the country to document any of that. And so he says to me, I can get you across the border into Burma, because I'm training the rebels here, and you can talk to all of these refugees who fled the capital cities. They're now in refugee camps along the border with Thailand. And so I said, well, you know, just so happens, I'm free, because I'm negotiating contracts with other stations. I'm going to tell you what I'll do. Take 2 weeks, pack a bag, I'll come over, and I'll do two-week kind of a thing. I thought it was going to be 2 weeks, Tom. It turned out to be 5.5 months I was
there. Yeah, you were living there. Oh, you were in situ, right.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, and keep in mind, I wasn't working for CBS anymore. I was freelancing. This is, when I say freelancing, it comes out of your pocket.
Yeah.
You pay for the whole excursion. So, you know, half the time I was there, I was living in a jungle combat zone in Burma, going out on patrols with the Burmese rebels. The other parts of the time, I was living out of cities like Bangkok, Tokyo, Seoul, Manila, as I'm trying to set up interviews with some of these, they weren't refugees. They were actually democratic leaders trying to fight for democracy who were living in exile. So I had to travel these other cities to do interviews with them. It was the greatest adventure of my life, being able to not only report the story, but produce the story. And I shot it all myself on my VHS camera.
Yeah. You're doing it all, right? Came booking everybody, yeah.
Everybody.
Yeah.
And, you know, so when the money ran out, it was time to come back, and I had my story. I finally decided when I came back to the U.S., it boiled down to the new NBC Ono in Miami or coming to WMAR-TV in Baltimore. Believe it or not, MAR made me a better offer than NBC Network did. I still had a house here for my first time. My agent was still here. Lots of great friends were still here. And I figured, okay, if I'm going to come back to the U.S. and start this whole cycle over, surely I felt like I would have a good shot at being successful coming back to Baltimore. And it turned out real well.
That was a good guess.
Oh, man. Helped them go from last place to first place in roughly about a year. And we were strong number one for, you know, at least the first 5 years I was there. And then you get a management change. You get an ownership change. And they decided to go in a different direction. And, you know, we were talking earlier about how money often dictates, you know, who goes and who stays. Well, they basically decided, okay, yeah, he took the station from last to first, but we just don't want to pay him what he's worth, you know. So then that sounds that, you know, it starts that downhill slide of, okay, now we're in this awkward situation, this awkward dance. And after 13 years, I just decided, nah, I'm not going to do this anymore. And at that point, interestingly enough, Tom, I considered getting out of the business, quitting the business after 32 years in the business. And,
I remember we talked briefly at that time about it because you were doing some consulting, you were doing some other things. But, you know, the thing is that, as you say, the managements of these stations follow the money. And when it comes to cutting the budget, they look to the people that are making more than the other people to start with them. But then there was also a non-compete. And that non-compete is a clause that's very common in your business, you know, for
Well, not
people.
Really. Not anymore.
Well, it seems common. Yeah.
20 years ago it was, but not anymore. Most states have got rid of the no-compete clauses. And for those who are listening in, what a no-compete says, if you're at one station in town, okay, we are not going to allow you to leave our station, go across the street to the competitors, and take all your audience with you. Okay, so for them, it was like, well, you're going to make us lose money. So they have these no-competes in the contracts where you have to sit out for a whole year before you're allowed to go to a competing station. And that's when I started doing, you know, consulting work. I was doing freelance work. Got a couple of movies parts in, you know, trying to put money on, you know, make some money.
You had a family.
Man,
you
know, sure.
You had to eat.
Sure. Yeah, kids' school tuitions, things like that. And ironically, I'm in Annapolis, and I'm testifying before a legislative committee about the insanity of the no-compete clauses. I'm testifying on one side against TV management's on the other side, okay? Management's talking about, oh, we have to have this to protect our interest and our investment. Yeah, but, you know, you already kicked me to the curb. There's no reason to keep me. If you wanted to keep me, you would have kept me, okay? So after this meeting, the president and general manager at WBAL said, Stan, let me talk to you for a second. His name is Bill Fine, by the way.
Bill
Great
Fine.
Guy. Great guy. Right?
He's retired now, but
Yeah. So he says, look, you know what? You know, and I know, these no-competes are really crazy. You've already finished out that no-compete year. I want to get you back over to BAL, but I don't have an anchor position. So I'm going to create a position just to get your foot in the door, to get it ball started. So he brought me in as a co-anchor of the Weekend Morning News. Okay.
Yeah.
Just to get my foot in the door. 3 weeks later, they add the entire week morning show. They also add the noon show. I guess it must have been a month and a half later. Now they add the 5 p.m. newscast to my lineup of duties. And so now I'm doing the 3 hours in the morning, going in at 4 o'clock in the morning, doing 3 hours in the morning, leaving at 8 o'clock, coming back at 3 p.m. to do the 5 p.m. newscast and oftentimes the 6 p.m. newscast, a split shift. And I did that for 11 years.
And they brought you back, and you were not at the salary level that you had left WMAR.
Of course not.
It was like they said, you know, here's this guy who's, you know, taken this other station from last to first. And, you know, they didn't, for whatever reason, have the wherewithal, or they said they didn't have the wherewithal to pay you, you know, what you had been used to making. So you had to make that decision that it was worth proving to them that that's what, you know, that you could be a value to that station.
Just give me an opportunity and I'll fly with it. And, you know, you'll be happy with the results. Yeah, of course.
And that's a tough work day. You know, 4 o'clock in the morning to 3 hours on the air in the morning. You know, I guess you got a little nap in the middle of the day or something.
I had to.
Yeah, of course, anyone would. And then go back and do, you know, the evening shifts as well. And then, you know, and do that until, you know, they were comfortable to say, yeah, you know, he is the same dude that did this the last time. Yeah. The other station.
Yeah, and then of course, you know, my coworker and longtime BAL anchor, Rod Daniels, decided to retire. I guess it was 2012, if I'm not mistaken. So that's when I finally came off the morning show and started doing the 5, 6, 11 p.m.
If you've just joined us, this is an archive edition of Midday. We're listening to a conversation I had with Stan Stovall, the longtime WBAL television news anchor, who retired this week after a 52-year career in broadcast journalism. He participated in his final newscast on Wednesday. Thanks for being with us on this day after Thanksgiving. Because my conversation with Stan Stovall was recorded earlier this year, we aren't able to take any new calls or online comments today. We'll have more of my conversation with Stan Stovall on the other side of a quick break. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
And welcome back to this archive edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for spending part of your Thanksgiving weekend with us. I appreciate it. Today, we're listening to a conversation I had in September with Stan Stovall, a beloved reporter and news anchor who's been with WBAL television for the past 20 years and a fixture on local airwaves for more than 40 years. Two nights ago, he signed off on the 6 o'clock newscast for the final time. This Thanksgiving weekend is the first weekend in what we hope will be a long and happy retirement. Stan first joined the team at WBAL in 1978, and after about 6 years, he moved to WMAR-TV, the ABC affiliate in Baltimore, where he sat at the anchor desk for 13 years. He rejoined WBAL in 2003. For a while, he anchored the morning broadcast, which began at 5 a.m., and every day he came back to the station to lead the 5 p.m. newscast as well. In 2013, he was named anchor of the 6 o'clock and the 11 o'clock broadcasts. Because our conversation was pre-recorded, we aren't able to take any new calls or online comments today. In the next part of our conversation, we talked about Stan's position in the media as a pioneering African American in broadcast journalism. Stan, I do want to talk to you about the racial barriers that you have busted through and helped others bust through as well. Mm-hmm. A recent survey of the television news business says about 12% of employees in newsrooms on TV are African American. Mm-hmm. That's roughly equivalent to the population, mm-hmm. you know. But this is a white dominated business. Mm-hmm. Public radio is certainly grappling with this. Many businesses are. The fact that you have been able to not only survive but thrive as an African American journalist, particularly coming up when you did, you mentioned you have family in Rochester, New York, but you also have family in Birmingham, Alabama.
Well, I did. They've all passed away. That's where my dad was born.
There was a piece in Baltimore Magazine. Jane Marion did a nice profile of you, mm-hmm. It turns out your aunt was a teacher of the girls who were killed in the 16th Street Church bombing.
Yeah, Sunday
in
school
Birmingham.
Teacher.
I mean, this hits the civil rights movement was very close to home.
Oh yeah.
I mean, how have you seen that evolution throughout your career?
Well, you know, being the age that I am, and I'm not ashamed to tell people, I'm approaching 70 years old now. And where have the years gone, man? I'm telling you, they've flown by. But being a young man growing up in the 50s, first in Rochester, New York, and then my family transplanting out to Phoenix, Arizona in 1961, as a youngster, well, let me put it this way. I first became aware of what the whole racial struggle was when my family took a drive down to Birmingham, Alabama. My great-grandmother was on her deathbed at her home. In 1958, we drive down, and even as a five-year-old child at that point, as we're heading to the South and getting into Alabama and pulling into Birmingham, I'm seeing the signs, you know, whites only and colored water fountain in the back and, no blacks allowed. Well, they didn't use blacks back then. Yeah,
right.
Coloreds, and that was nice. The part of town where my great-grandmother lived, no streetlights, no sidewalks, outhouses. But on the other side of town, they had all the modern conveniences and things like that. And I'm thinking, wow. Oh, and my dad telling me, okay. And I'm 5 years old, keep in mind, Tom. My dad telling a five-year-old, now don't look white people directly in the eye. Don't look white people directly in the eye. And I'm thinking, well, why not? And him trying to, but him not explaining fully why. Okay, so that was bizarre, number
and
one.
And almost, how can you do a five-year-old? I mean, who can comprehend?
Exactly. Yeah. All right, we go through that Birmingham experience, and I knew, well, that's different certainly from New York. Okay, so then we move out to Arizona in 1961, where the African-American population for the state was only 2%.
Right.
2%.
Yeah, you had to be one of three black people in all of Phoenix.
Well, I would say probably one, two, three of the schools that my brother and I, my brother's only 14 months younger than me, we were the only black students in the whole school.
Sure.
Okay, I certainly took my share of being called the N-word and exacerbated by the fact that I had this New York accent and I wore glasses. Yeah. Oh, kids just like... they were unmerciful.
It was the trifecta.
Oh,
yeah.
My goodness.
Right.
You're trying to talk white. I'm thinking, what does that mean? Okay? I'm a great student. You're trying to be white. What does that mean? You know, and this is coming from the very small black community that we were trying to, shift into. Large Hispanic community and whatever and that. But you know what, Tom? Once I've learned that communication... people are ignorant when they don't know someone. They don't have a chance to talk to someone to get to know them. And when you talk to people, they understand, you're just like me. You're just like me. And that breaks down a lot
of
racial barriers.
Right.
So we'll fast forward now to 1970, getting involved in the business. I was a delegate. I was elected class president for my senior year of high school. I ran for that office because I knew I'd have to give a speech in front of the entire school, campaign speech. I was trying to get over stage fright. I was a great student, but I couldn't stand to get up in front of a large group. You know, it was like
it's
the Albert.
It's funny to think of you
Albert
having
Brooks
stage
scene.
Fright.
Yeah, the Albert Brooks scene in Broadcast News with the sweats just running down his face. That was me. So I knew I had to get rid of this debilitating stage fright, and that's why I decided to run. Delegate from my high school, go to the Arizona Boys State program. I'm on a roll. I give three more speeches. I win mayor. I win county executive. I win chief justice of the Arizona Supreme Court. Had to give speeches for all. Week after I graduated, I get a phone call. Hi, my name is Ernest W. McFarland, who was a former U.S. Senator, former Congressman, former Governor, former actual Arizona Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
But he owned a TV station.
He was the sponsor of the Boise State's program. I said, I had a chance to hear you give all of your speeches. What are you doing for the summer? I said, well, probably summer school or looking for a job. He said, how would you like to work for me? I said, what do you do? And he said, I own the ABC TV affiliate in Phoenix. You have to understand, prior to 1968, you didn't see African-Americans on TV anywhere in America.
I mean, in 1970, I mean, that's 5 years after the Voting Rights Act. It's 6 years after the Civil Rights Act. These were new things at that time.
Yeah, with the assassination of Dr. King, there was an awakening. Okay, we can't continue to do this dance this way. The FCC starting to put pressure on TV stations. You have to integrate your staffs. Certainly, there's more that lived in Phoenix than just white males. Okay, this gentleman, as an owner of a TV station, was trying to get out from underneath the wrath of the FCC, which was threatening to yank licenses to operate if you didn't integrate your staffs. I tell people, when they ask, how'd you get in the business? Being in the right place at the right time, the Boise State program, showing an aptitude for doing public speaking, those three speeches, and being African-American. And I had an opportunity to get my foot in the door. He was a progressive. He was a Democrat in a red state. And he was progressive. Ernest McFarland, by the way, was the original sponsor of the GI Bill. After the Korean War.
Wow.
Yeah. So he was progressive.
Which many African-Americans were not able to take advantage of.
There you go.
But that's another conversation for a different day.
Yeah, but he was obviously interested in being, the first to integrate the TV industry in Arizona. Gave me an opportunity as a young man. Didn't matter the age. He was like, he's the first one I saw who could do some public speaking, and he's black. Let's give him a shot. So I walk in the door, 17-year-old, thinking, public school education my whole life, no formal training in broadcasting. I'm going to be a gopher. Go for this, go for that, you know, that kind of thing. I had no idea he had other ideas in mind. Second week on the job, I walk in the building and hand me a news camera, a press release as I go out and cover that story. And that's how I learned the business, through trial and error.
Yeah, yeah. More success than errors, that's to be sure. Yeah. But what's your advice to young African-Americans getting into journalism in general and television in particular?
Yeah. I'm proud to say that I've mentored a lot of people. I felt it was my responsibility as being one of the first in the industry to bring people along with me, help them to also come into the industry. So I've mentored lots and lots of people. I get calls all the time. And this, by the way, is not just for African-American students, white students, Hispanic students. I'm open to anybody who wants to learn. And I've always availed myself to anybody who calls and, can I come and visit you at the station? Can I take a tour? Can I sit in on a newscast? Can you come and speak to our class? Whatever. And that's just been me for over 52 years now. And I'll probably continue to do that. But my advice to them is, number one, there's going to be a lot of frustrations in this business. And just because someone says no, don't let that measure your content or your ability. I've heard no a couple of times. Okay. And you know what? You just have to pick yourself up and keep going. I remember after I left Phoenix, I'm in St. Louis, the NBC affiliate there, and our station manager calls me into the office, his office one time, and he says to me, and keep in mind, I'm only 23 years old at the time. He says, young man, I'm not sure you're going to make it in this business. And I'm thinking, all right, well, I've made it so far for 5.5 years at that point. And I had heard some stories from co-workers about this guy pulling this routine. And so, and the routine was, the other two people that notoriously that he told the same line to, Bob Jamison, former NBC News correspondent, Hall of Famer, and Joe Garagiola, another Hall of Famer. Those are the other two people this guy said the same thing to.
Former host of the Today Show, et cetera.
Right. So when he said it to me, I said, oh, thank you very much. And I shook his hand. And he looked at me like, oh, this young man is crazy, you know. But I figured that's a great endorsement. If he told the same thing to Joe Garagiola and Bob Jamison, I'm on my way. You know, he didn't get that. Yeah.
How, I mean, can you point specifically to how your experience, for example, doing the foreign work that you did in Burma or in Central America, and the fact that, you know, your experience as one of the few African-American kids in your high school in Phoenix and the obviously, you know, growing up in the post Martin Luther King civil rights era, how does that inform your work as an anchor? You know, when you're sitting behind the desk, it's different than being in the field.
Yep.
And why is that experience important to you and to the viewer?
Well, number one, you'd be surprised how many people grow up in a town and don't have the opportunity to get out of that town in any way, shape, or form. Now, it's different now because of the internet. You can go on the internet and discover a lot of things about the world. But when I was a youngster, you know, you grew up in your hometown. Oftentimes, you died in your hometown, and you did very little. Being able to travel the world and cover stories around the world has given me a worldly perspective that makes me appreciative, number one. I know people think that, and there are major, major problems here in America, but you don't know how good you've got it here until you travel elsewhere and see how other people live and how other people are oppressed and, you know, things like that. I mean, I got locked up in Moscow in the Soviet Union before the collapse of the Soviet Union simply because, number one, I was the only black person walking the street at the time.
Okay, I bet, yeah.
You know, and I didn't have my in order to get into the Soviet Union before the fall of communism, you had to be sponsored by a high Communist Party official to come in. This was a group of young, I went with a group of young African-American males from here in Baltimore under the Project Survival program, and we were on our way to Odessa, which is a sister city to Baltimore, okay? Basketball tournament, but also educational and you know, sightseeing and meeting government and whatever and that. And I had to come back before the rest of them, so I'm traveling alone. I didn't have my high Communist Party official who sponsored me to get into the country traveling with me. I get into Moscow. I don't have my sponsor. It's everybody has to be off the street by midnight in Moscow back then. This was 1989. And my flight got in from Odessa into Moscow late. I take the cab to the Central Sports School where I was supposed to be staying overnight before getting an Aeroflot flight the next day. It was all locked up, all dark. Cab driver motions me, get back in the cab. Throws my bags in the cab. He drives me to the Central District Police Station in Moscow. It's 12:30 in the morning now. And they look at me walking up the steps like the spook who came out of the cold, man. I'm telling you, it's like, what is going on? The only people of color you ever saw in Russia at that time were either Angolan or Cuban, and they were military. They were there to be military trained because they were satellite states for the Soviet Union. Well, I wasn't military, so passport. So now they look at my passport, and they see all these stamps from Central America, Southeast Asia, where, you know, and they're, oh, this guy's not a journalist. He's a spy. He's a spy. I go through 4 hours of interrogation. It was getting hot, Tom. I'm telling you.
I bet.
Yeah. And you know what you know what calmed it down? So it's in August. It's hot. And I've got a shirt much like this on. I'm still a competitive bodybuilder at the time, right? I walk in and the adrenaline's running, so I'm pumped. And the guy finally says to me, Desk Sergeant, the weightlifter? And I said, there's
something
my,
common.
There's my, and then I started throwing out all these Russian, Vasily Alexeyev, all the Russian weightlifters I knew, and it calmed the thing down. It calmed the thing down. I didn't get slapped around, but I did get locked up overnight. Got locked up overnight, and the next day I got a police escort to the airport. They literally walked me through the airport, onto the tarmac, and stood at the bottom of the steps until I got on the plane.
Bye-bye.
There you go. There you go.
If you've just joined us, this is an encore presentation of Midday. We're listening to a conversation I had with Stan Stovall, who retired this week after 40 years as a news anchor at both WMAR and WBAL television. Our conversation was pre-recorded, so we can't take any new calls or online comments today. Our good friend Charles Robinson from MPT says, love hearing the stories from Stan about his career. I'm a big fan. He says, don't forget to ask him about weightlifting. And so you and I will talk about that. Jason says, Stan is a Baltimore institution. I'm happy for him, but at the same time, he will be missed. Chris tweets, I was always a WJZ guy myself, but Stan deserves as much applause on his way out as Bob Turk does. And we did learn earlier this week on social media that Bob Turk had WJZ, longtime weatherman, will be signing off on Friday, I believe, this week. So we have a caller, John. We understand John is back. John, welcome to Midday with Stan Stovall.
Oh, I want to wish Stan happy retirement.
Thank you, sir.
And I'm the person, I used to make six egg fouillon for you.
Who? Six egg fouillon? And where? What restaurant?
At the club.
Oh! You mean down at the DAC?
Right.
Oh my goodness! How you doing?
Very good. How about you?
I'm doing just fine. You probably remember Tom from the club too, right?
Yeah. I do.
Yeah. That's great, John. Well, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Okay. Dwayne is on the line from Curtis Bay. Dwayne, welcome to Midday with Stan Stovall.
Thanks a lot. I've been watching Baltimore television since the 1950s. And I remember when the three TV stations started in 1947 and 48.
Wow.
WMAR, which used to be owned for a long time by the Baltimore Sun Papers newspaper,
yep,
was almost never, never number one. They were always number three. Channel 13 WJZ since the 60s with Jerry Turner and Al Sanders always used to be number one. But I got to tell you, I always preferred WBAL TV news. But he should know, Mr. Stovall should know, that his picture is in a book called Baltimore Radio and Television that was published in 2019 by Arcadia Publishing, which publishes local histories. There's about 100 different volumes on Baltimore and Maryland, and he's in the one for Baltimore Radio and Television. You
I'll
can
be
get it at their you can get it at ArcadiaPublishing.com's website or
oh,
go to a
great
bookstore.
That's great, Dwayne.
I wanted to ask him when David Brinkley went to ABC way back when and took over the commentary program for Sunday. And Richard Scheer is doing Square Off continuously. So what are you going to do in your retirement? We don't want to lose your abilities. Can you do a talk show or commentary? Because that's sadly needed.
All right. Well, thanks, Dwayne. Appreciate it. So, yeah, what are the plans?
Well, I mean, Dwayne, you're going to make me work more. Are you, Dwayne? Okay. Well, let me tell you, what I've been working on for the last, oh, my goodness, 6 months. I have a former grade school, high school, college classmate whose son is on death row in Arizona for a crime his family certainly believes, and since I've gotten involved in the story, I believe he did not convict. Wrongly convicted, he's on death row. I've been working with his family for the past year now, first putting him in touch with the Innocence Project, trying to get them involved in the case, and right now I'm in negotiations with NBC about getting a podcast on to open eyes and shed new light on this case, much like the Adnan Syed case.
Yeah, look what a podcast did for the Adnan Syed.
Well, there you
we
go.
Just talked to Erica Souter, who is a post-conviction lawyer,
yeah,
and who's Mr. Syed's lawyer. She was on the show just the other day.
Right.
So this is something that, you know, and podcasts can be very helpful in the causes.
Yeah, I originally pitched it as a Dateline NBC piece. The executive producer said, the story is so complicated that I'm not sure we can get it into a one-hour Dateline format, but perhaps we have other opportunities with our podcast, things like that. So that's where our negotiations are right now, trying to finalize a podcast to get this story the attention it deserves in hopes of getting a new trial, much like Adnan Syed did, to prove this young man's innocence and that's all you can tell. And the major
project
difference between Adnan Syed's case and this young man, Adnan was facing just a life sentence. This young man is facing a death sentence in a red state that is actively carrying out death penalties in Arizona. So
we'll keep our eye on that. Stan Stovall, the longtime anchor at WBAL Television, announced his intention to retire last year. He had his final day at the anchor desk on Wednesday of this week. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to an encore edition of Midday. I spoke with Stan Stovall about his career and his many years on the airwaves in Baltimore in September. Stan's career began in Phoenix, Arizona, where he spent much of his childhood. He was an anchor at a station in Phoenix at the tender age of 18. He went on to hold positions in Philadelphia and St. Louis. He also did reporting from several foreign destinations. He worked at WBAL-TV for several years, beginning in 1978. He was an anchor at WMAR Television for 13 years, and he rejoined WBAL in 2003. He has held the anchor position on the 6 o'clock and 11 o'clock broadcasts for the past 10 years. We'll listen to more of my conversation with Stan Stovall on the other side of a quick break. A reminder that because our show was recorded earlier, we can't take any new calls or online comments today. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back to this archive edition of Midday on this Thanksgiving weekend. I'm Tom Hall. I hope you had a nice holiday yesterday, and I appreciate your spending part of your day today with me. If you've just joined us, we're listening to a conversation I had in September with Stan Stovall, a fixture on Baltimore television for more than 40 years. His tenure here included work as an anchor at both WMAR Television, the ABC affiliate in town, as well as WBAL, the NBC affiliate in the Baltimore metro region. He's won an Emmy and many other awards. In the late 1980s, Stan spent 2 months in war-torn Burma, which is now Myanmar, covering the conflict there. He has also reported from Russia, Ukraine, and Italy. As of a few years ago, 12% of all TV newsroom employees were African American. While that is roughly equivalent to the percentage of the U.S. population that is African American, there is no doubt that how the news is shaped and presented on TV, in print, on radio, and on the internet is overwhelmingly controlled by white journalists and executives. Stan Stovall was a trailblazer as an African American reporter and anchor. At the age of 18, he became the youngest anchor in the United States and the first African-American anchor in the state of Arizona. He has helped break down racial barriers in white-dominated newsrooms ever since. 2 years ago, he passed the 50-year mark in the news business as an anchor and reporter. He has retired from WBAL-TV, and today we are listening to a conversation in which he reflected on his career and the state of local and national journalism. As our conversation continued, we talked about Stan's success as a powerlifter and bodybuilder as well. Our conversation continued with a caller named Eugene. Eugene is on the line from White Marsh. Hi, Eugene. Welcome to the show.
Connection's a little better. Pardon my dog in the background if she decides to bark, but I wanted to wish Stovall a nice retirement.
Thank you, Gene.
I also delve more into the fact that he was into bodybuilding. That story in Moscow, I find it interesting more so from the conditioning aspect. I want to know, like, did you ever compete, and was that something that you ever talked about during your newscast?
He did compete. He did compete, indeed. Yeah, I mean, you and I used to run into each other at the gym.
Yeah, I probably ran into you more in the gym than I did when you were doing the Choral Arts Society, and I was emceeing your Christmas holiday programs.
Yeah, you did that, too. Sure.
Yes, I did. Just a little background history, okay? So I was a pretty good athlete in high school. Actually, I was a really good athlete in high school, all conference in football, basketball, went to school in Phoenix, Arizona. I wanted to play football at Arizona State University, which was a football factory. Frank Cush, who was a former Baltimore Colts head coach, he was the football coach at Arizona State at the time. So after I graduated from high school, now keep in mind I'm already in TV at the time, but I went to Arizona State University on a partial scholarship and partial grant. I walked into his office as an 18-year-old kid and said, "Excuse me, Coach Cush, I'd like to play football for you." And he said to me, "Oh, yeah, well, show up at the walk-on camp. Now get the hell out of my office." and I was so used to being pampered as an athlete in high school, I'm thinking, well, that's the wrong attitude. So what I did was I joined the local downtown Phoenix YMCA with the intention of training on the weights, putting on 15 pounds, so that when I came back for the walk-on camp to try out for the team, I'd be much bigger and much stronger. When I graduated from high school, I only weighed about 175. By the end of the summer, I weighed 190. But the important thing is, that gym that I joined, which was the only powerhouse gym, so to speak, in Phoenix at the time, there were 5 world record-holding power lifters who trained in that gym. They recognized me from TV, took me under their wing, showed me the proper way to train, and got me interested in competitive powerlifting right that summer. And I won a teenage state powerlifting championship at the age of 18 that very first summer, which provided the motivation for me to keep at it. I ended up trying out for the Arizona State basketball team instead, made the team, but I continued with the weights, which made me help me with my basketball game. Well, after my freshman year, only played 1 year, I realized, you know what? I'm 6'1", I weigh 190 pounds, I'm not going to the NBA. What am I doing? Okay. While I'm working part-time at the ABC affiliate and going to school full-time, I never slept those first 2 years of college. So I quit the basketball team, and I joined the university powerlifting team. and competed in two NCAA championships.
I didn't know they had teams for that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Cool. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. And competed in two NCAA championships, finished in the top five both times. But by then, man, I'm rocketing in the gym and doing very well in AAU sanctioned powerlifting contest. My training partner was a former Mr. USA. He was a world record holding powerlifter as well. And so, you know, he took me under the wing, and I took off with it. And so when I left Phoenix, I just continued it. Moved on to Missouri, won three state powerlifting championships there. And by the time I moved to Maryland in 1978, I decided, you know what, I think I've had it with the powerlifting, because it does take a toll on your body. I'm going to switch strictly to bodybuilding. And so in 1980, I entered and won the 1980 Mr. Maryland and Mr. South Atlantic. I left town, went back to St. Louis, moved to Philadelphia, living overseas. When I came back to Baltimore in 89, I wanted to get back into the competition. In 1990, I won the Mr. Delmarva bodybuilding competition. And in 2000, what was it, 1999, I guess I won the Baltimore City bodybuilding championships. But, you know, when you start to have kids, okay, you lose your training time. So that was the end of the competition. Yeah.
No, Eugene, he is the real deal. And I can tell all of our listeners, he still looks great. Let's go back to the phones. I think we have Tyrone back. Tyrone, let's give this another go. How you doing?
I'm better. I'm outside. I was in the basement when you called.
Hey, Ty.
Or when
great.
I called.
Great.
Yeah. Well, first, Stan, thanks for your service. And I can tell you, you were the first black anchor in Baltimore that I saw as a kid.
Hmm.
You've been doing this as long as I've been alive. I'm 45 years old. You've been doing it for 50. I remember back in 1982, 83, 84, you were on Action News when it was Rudy Miller, Sheila Steinbeck, and it was you had a black suit and a TWA. For those who aren't aware, that's a teeny weeny afro. And I'm like, oh, wait a minute. This person looks like me. And he was the only man, the only black man at the time who looked like me.
Interesting.
Locally. I didn't see Al Sanders till later on.
Interesting.
Because
Al was on the air here in Baltimore before I came to town. I think he came to town maybe a year or two before I got to town.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I didn't see him till later on. As far as WJZ is concerned, and as far as TV.
Yeah.
But when I saw you in that suit, and then to make matters quote unquote worse, they have a YouTube of all the WBAL of the WBAL opens, and they have you with that Action News theme song.
Sure.
Doing people work, and that was a nice fro you had too. And thanks for giving communications at least knowing how to deliver the news a space and place and say, okay, folks who look like me can do this too, because as you said, it's very, very alabaster.
Yeah.
To put it nicely.
Well, thank you, Tyrone. That's fantastic. But I appreciate the comment.
I appreciate
and
your
we're
going
to have to make that the last word. Stan Stovall, thank you so much. It's
Tom,
so great, and congratulations.
Been a pleasure, buddy.
On a terrific, terrific run.
Thank you for your support and being a good friend for a long time.
Well, and that will continue on and off the air. Stan Stovall is an award-winning journalist and anchor who this week retired from WBAL television. We spoke in September. That's it for us today on this encore presentation of Midday. Our show is available on the radio or on demand. You can subscribe to the Midday podcast, which is available wherever you get your podcasts. If you have an idea for a topic you'd like us to tackle, drop us an email. Our address is midday@wipr.org. You can follow us on Twitter @MiddayWIPR, and you can follow me @TomHallWIPR. Midday's director and engineer is Shania Mapson. Luke Spicknell is WIPR's operations manager. Taria Rogers, Rob Sivak, and Mallory Pinkard-Pierre produce our program. Austin Coghlan from Clean Cut wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. Reveal is up next after news at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great holiday weekend.
Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.